This episode of the OrthoBullets podcast will go over the topic of spinal cord injuries from the spine section on orthobullets.com. And just FYI, this is in the top 5 most tested topics from the spine section. So let's start with the epidemiology. The incidence of spinal cord injuries is 11,000 new cases per year in the United States, and specifically 34% are incomplete tetraplegia, with central cord syndrome being the most common. 25% are complete paraplegia, 22% are complete tetraplegia, and 17% are incomplete paraplegia. As far as the demographics, there is a bimodal distribution. Young individuals with significant trauma and older individuals that have minor trauma compounded by degenerative spinal canal narrowing. As far as the location of injuries, 50% occur in the cervical spine. With respect to the mechanism, MVA causes 50% of these injuries. Other mechanisms include falls, gunshot wounds, and iatrogenic injuries. And speaking of which, it is estimated that 3 to 25% of all spinal cord injuries occur after the initial traumatic episode due to improper immobilization and transport. As far as the pathophysiology, the primary injury is damage to the neural tissue due to direct trauma, and this is irreversible. The secondary injury is injury to adjacent tissue due to decreased perfusion, lipid peroxidation, free radical / cytokines, and cell apoptosis. Methylprednisone is used to prevent secondary injury by improving perfusion, inhibiting lipid peroxidation, and decreasing the release of free radicals. Associated conditions with spinal cord injuries include acute phase conditions like spinal shock and neurogenic shock, which we'll talk more about later in the episode. Associated injuries with spinal cord injuries include closed head injuries, non-contiguous spinal fractures, and vertebral artery injury. Risk factors for vertebral artery injury include atlas fractures and facet dislocations. Most people with a unilateral injury remain asymptomatic. Imaging, like magnetic resonance angiography, is the least invasive method, and treatment involves stenting only if the patient is symptomatic from basilar artery insufficiency. As far as prognosis after spinal cord injuries, only 1% have complete recovery at the time of hospital diagnosis. Conus medullaris syndrome has a better prognosis for recovery than more proximal lesions. Now let's go over some relevant anatomy. The central nervous system includes the brain and the spinal cord. The spinal cord ends at L3 at birth and L1 at maturity. The peripheral nervous system contains the cranial nerves and the peripheral nerves. The autonomic nervous system contains the sympathetic system and the parasympathetic system. The sympathetic system has a total of 22 ganglia, 3 cervical, 11 thoracic, 4 lumbar, and 4 sacral. As far as the cervical ganglia, the 3 cervical ganglia include the stellate, middle, and superior. The middle ganglion is the most at risk at the level of C6, where it lies close to the medial border of the longus coli muscles. Injury to the middle ganglion / sympathetic chain will lead to Horner syndrome. The parasympathetic nervous system is made from a hypogastric plexus and formed by the S2, S3, and S4 parasympathetic fibers, as well as the lumbar sympathetic fibers, also known as the splanchnic nerves. So, as a brief spinal cord overview, the spinal cord extends from the brainstem to the inferior border of L1. The conus medullaris is the termination of the spinal cord. The phylum terminale is the residual fragment of the spinal cord that extends from the conus medullaris to the sacrum. The thecal sac is the dural surrounded sac that extends from the spinal cord and contains CSF, nerve roots, and the caudoquina. The caudoquina is nerve roots and the phylum terminale surrounded by dura that extends from the spinal cord. The layers of the spinal cord include the dura mater, which is outside, the arachnoid, and the pia mater, which is inside. As far as the spinal cord functional tracts, the ascending tracts are sensory and the descending tracts are motor. The ascending tracts contain dorsal columns, or the posterior funiculi, which are responsible for deep touch, proprioception, and vibratory sensation. The lateral spinal thalamic tract is responsible for pain and temperature and is also the site of a chordotomy to alleviate intractable pain. And the ventral spinal thalamic tract is responsible for light touch. Moving on to the descending tracts, the lateral corticospinal tract is the main voluntary motor tract. The upper extremity motor pathways are more medial or central, which explains why a central cord injury affects the upper extremities more than the lower extremities. The ventral corticospinal tract is also responsible for voluntary motor control. As far as blood supply, spinal cord blood supply is provided by the anterior spinal artery, which is the primary blood supply of the anterior two-thirds of the spinal cord, including both the lateral corticospinal tract and the ventral corticospinal tract. The posterior spinal artery, right and left, are the primary blood supply to the dorsal sensory columns. The artery of Ademkowitz is the largest anterior segmental artery and typically arises from the left posterior intercostal artery, which branches from the aorta and supplies the lower two-thirds of the spinal cord via the anterior spinal artery. Significant variation exists, as in 75% of people, it originates on the left side between the T8 and L1 vertebral segments. Cerebrospinal fluid, of course, is a colorless fluid that occupies the subarachnoid space surrounding the brain, spinal cord, and ventricular system. The subarachnoid space is between the arachnoid mater and the pia mater. CSF provides mechanical and immunological protection for the brain, spinal cord, and thecal sac. Most human CSF is produced by the choroid plexus in the third, fourth, and lateral ventricles of the brain. CSF is an ultrafiltrate of blood plasma through the permeable capillaries of the choroid plexus. Total CSF volume between the brain, spinal cord, and the thecal sac is approximately 150 milliliters. CSF formation occurs at the rate of approximately 500 milliliters per day. Thus, the total amount of CSF is turned over 3 to 4 times per day. As far as nerve root anatomy, in the cervical spine, nerve roots exit above the corresponding pedicle. So, for example, the C5 nerve root exits above the C5 pedicle. The nerve root will travel horizontally to exit, and remember that there is an extra C8 nerve root that does not have a corresponding vertebral body. In the thoracic spine, the nerve root will travel below the corresponding pedicle. So T1 exits below the T1 pedicle, and T12 exits below the T12 pedicle. In the lumbar spine, the nerve roots will actually descend vertically before exiting, and the nerve root will travel below the corresponding pedicle. So L1 exits below the L1 pedicle, and L5 exits below the L5 pedicle. Now, going back to spinal cord injuries, let's talk about classification of spinal cord injuries. And the classification is largely descriptive. So tetraplegia, paraplegia, complete injury, and incomplete injury is how these injuries are typically classified. Tetraplegia is an injury to the cervical spinal cord leading to impairment of function in the arms, trunk, legs, and pelvic organs. Paraplegia is an injury to the thoracic, lumbar, or sacral segments leading to impairment of function in the trunk, legs, and pelvic organs, depending on the level of injury. Arm function is preserved. Complete injury is an injury with no spared motor or sensory function below the affected level. Patients must have recovered from spinal shock, meaning the bulbocavernosus reflex is intact before an injury can be determined as complete. This is classified as an ASIA A. And we'll go over the ASIA classification in more detail in a bit. An incomplete injury is an injury with some preserved motor or sensory function below the injury level. Some examples of incomplete spinal cord injuries include anterior cord syndrome, Brown-Séquard syndrome, central cord syndrome, posterior cord syndrome, conus medullaris syndromes, and cauda equina syndrome. And we'll go into each of these incomplete spinal cord injuries in another episode. Now let's talk in more detail about the ASIA classification, or the American Spinal Injury Association classification. The first thing you want to do is determine if the patient is in spinal shock, and that's determined by checking the bulbocavernosus reflex. Then number two, you want to determine the neurologic level of injury. So you do this by figuring out the lowest segment with intact sensation and anti-gravity muscle function strength that is a muscle grade of 3 or more. And remember, in regions where there is no myotome to test, the motor level is presumed to be the same as the sensory level. Next, number three, determine whether the injury is complete or incomplete. Complete is defined as no voluntary anal contraction and 0 out of 5 distal motor and 0 out of 2 distal sensory scores, and no perianal sensation. And the bulbocavernosus reflex is present, meaning the patient is no longer in spinal shock. An incomplete spinal cord injury is defined as voluntary anal contraction, also referred to as sacral sparing, and sacral sparing is critical to determine complete versus incomplete spinal cord injury. Then finally, number four, you will determine the ASIA impairment scale grade. So it's very likely that you'll be asked a question about spinal cord injuries and classifying them according to the ASIA classification system. So the ASIA system is pretty simple. write down A, B, C, D, and E. Just remember E is normal, or remember the mnemonic, strong as an Asian elephant. A is absolutely no motor or sensory. C is halfway in between, or less than 50% of the muscles are grade 3 or above. D is greater than 50% of the muscles are grade 3 or above. And B, remember, is barely anything and sensory only. Now let's talk a little bit more about acute phase conditions. So neurogenic shock is characterized by hypotension and relative bradycardia in a patient with an acute spinal cord injury. This is potentially fatal. The mechanism is circulatory collapse from loss of sympathetic tone. Disruption of the autonomic pathway within the spinal cord leads to lack of sympathetic tone, decreased systemic vascular resistance, pooling of blood in the extremities, and hypotension. Treatment is with Swan-Ganz monitoring for careful fluid management and pressors to treat hypotension. Spinal shock is defined as temporary loss of spinal cord function and reflex activity below the level of a spinal cord injury. It is characterized by flaccid areflexic paralysis as well as bradycardia and hypotension due to loss of sympathetic tone. It's also characterized by an absent bulbocavernosus reflex, which is a reflex characterized by anal sphincter contraction in response to squeezing the gland's penis or tugging an indwelling Foley catheter. As far as the timing of spinal shock, it's variable but usually resolves within 48 hours. At its conclusion, spasticity, hyperreflexia, and clonus will slowly progress over days to weeks. As far as the mechanism of spinal shock, it is neurophysiologic in nature. Neurons become hyperpolarized and unresponsive to stimuli from the brain. Evaluation of these patients is obviously extremely important because one cannot evaluate neurologic deficit until the spinal shock phase has resolved. The end of spinal shock is indicated by the return of the bulbocavernosus reflex. Conus or quadroquina injuries may lead to permanent loss of the bulbocavernosus reflex. Spinal shock is ruled out when the bulbocavernosus reflex is present and when 48 hours has elapsed from the time of injury. There are four stages of spinal shock. Phase 1 is areflexia / hyporeflexic for 0 to 48 hours. Phase 2 is the initial reflex return after 1 to 2 days. Polysynaptic reflexes like the bulbocavernosus reflex return, while monosynaptic reflexes like the patellar reflex remain absent. Phase 3 is the initial hyperreflexia for 1 to 4 weeks, and phase 4 is characterized by spasticity for 1 to 12 months and is also characterized by altered skeletal performance. Now let's quickly compare spinal shock, neurogenic shock, and hypovolemic shock based on various parameters like blood pressure, pulse, reflexes, motor, time frame after injury, and mechanism. So with respect to blood pressure, all three types of shock will show hypotension. With respect to pulse, spinal and neurogenic shock will show bradycardia, while hypovolemic shock will show tachycardia. As far as reflexes like the bulbocavernosus reflex, in spinal shock this will be absent, while in neurogenic or hypovolemic shock it will be variable / independent. As far as motor function, spinal shock is characterized by flaccid paralysis, while neurogenic and hypovolemic shock, motor function will be variable / independent. As far as time frame after injury, both spinal shock and neurogenic shock can occur approximately 48 to 72 hours immediately after spinal cord injury, while hypovolemic shock will obviously occur following excessive blood loss. With respect to the mechanism of each of these types of shock, in spinal shock, peripheral neurons become temporarily unresponsive to brain stimuli. In neurogenic shock, disruption of the autonomic pathway leads to loss of sympathetic tone and decreased systemic vascular resistance, while hypovolemic shock is due to decreased preload, which leads to a decreased cardiac output. Now moving on to evaluation, as far as field treatment of potential spinal cord injuries begins at the accident scene with proper spinal immobilization. Immobilization should include a rigid cervical collar and transport on a firm spine board with lateral support devices. The patient should be rolled with standard log roll techniques with control of the cervical spine. Spine boards should be used for transport only, and patients should be removed when clinically safe. Decubitus ulcers can occur after only 30 to 60 minutes on a backboard. With respect to athletes, in the setting of sports-related injuries, helmets and shoulder pads should be left on until arrival at the hospital or until experienced personnel can perform simultaneous removal of the helmet and shoulder pads in a controlled situation. Initial evaluation should include the primary survey, so the ABCs, airway, breathing, circulation. Keep in mind that spinal cord injury above C5 is likely to require intubation. Initial survey should also inspect for obvious injuries of the head and spine. Visual and manual inspection of the entire spine should be performed. A seatbelt sign or abdominal ecchymosis should raise suspicion for flexion distraction injuries of the thoracolumbar spine. Secondary survey should include a cervical spine exam, which involves removing the immobilization collar and examining the face and scalp for evidence of direct trauma. Inspect for angular or rotational deformities in the holding position of the patient's head. Rotational deformity may indicate a unilateral facet dislocation. Palpate the posterior cervical spine looking for tenderness along the midline or paraspinal tissues. Absence of posterior midline tenderness in the awake, alert patient predicts low probability of significant cervical injury. Log roll the patient to inspect and palpate the entire spinal axis, and perform a careful neurologic exam before cervical spine clearance. As far as initial medical treatment, DVT prophylaxis is indicated in most patients. Contraindications include coagulopathy or hemorrhage. Modalities of prophylaxis include low molecular weight heparin, a rotating bed, and pneumatic compression stockings. As far as cardiopulmonary management, careful hemodynamic monitoring and stabilization is critical in early treatment. Hypotension should be avoided. Implement immediate aggressive pulmonary protocols. In addition, make sure to have proper decubitus ulcer prevention. As far as steroids, high-dose methylprednisone were used historically. However, current literature and available guidelines recommend against administration due to lack of clear clinical benefit and risk of complications. Historical indications were for non-penetrating spinal cord injury within 8 hours of injury, recommended by the National Acute Spinal Cord Injury Study 3. Historical contraindications included gunshot wounds, pregnancy, age under 13 years old, greater than 8 hours after injury, and brachial plexus injuries or other peripheral nerve injuries. Previously, the technique for steroids was load 30 milligrams per kilogram over the first hour, or 2 grams for a 70 kilogram male, then use a 5.4 milligram per kilogram per hour drip for 23 hours if started less than 3 hours after the injury, or for 47 hours if started 3 to 8 hours after the injury. As far as outcomes, it was thought steroids may lead to improved root function at the level of the injury. However, they may be associated with significant complications. Monosialotetrahexosyl ganglioside, or GM1, remains controversial as a large multicenter randomized controlled trial did not show long-term benefit. However, there is some evidence of faster recovery. As far as reductions, acute close reduction with axial traction is indicated in an alert and oriented patient with neurologic deficits and compression due to fracture/dislocation. Bilateral facet dislocation with a spinal cord injury in an alert and oriented patient is the most common reason to perform acute reduction with axial traction. Reasons to abort reduction is over-distraction, worsening neurologic exam, and failure to obtain reduction. Definitive treatment for spinal cord injury can be either non-operative or operative. Non-operative involves bracing and observation, and this is indicated mostly for most gunshot wounds. However, we'll talk about some exceptions in a moment. Operative options include surgical decompression and stabilization, which is indicated in most incomplete spinal cord injuries except gunshot wounds. Decompress when the patient hits a neurologic plateau or if they are worsening neurologically. Decompression may facilitate nerve root function return at the level of the injury, and it may recover 1 to 2 levels. Surgical decompression and stabilization is also indicated for most complete spinal cord injuries except in gunshot wounds. In these cases, you will stabilize the spine to facilitate rehab and minimize need for a halo or orthosis. Decompression may facilitate nerve root function return at the level of the injury. These patients may recover 1 to 2 levels. Complete spinal cord injuries will be considered for tendon transfers, for example, deltoid to triceps transfers for C5 or C6 spinal cord injuries. Surgical decompression and stabilization is also indicated for gunshot wounds with progressive neurological deterioration with a retained bullet within the spinal canal or a gunshot wound associated with acquired Aquina syndrome or a retained bullet fragment within the thecal sac as CSF leads to the breakdown of lead products that may lead to lead poisoning. Moving on to rehabilitation, the goal is to assess and identify mechanisms for reintegration into the community based on functional level and daily needs. Patients learn transfer techniques self-care retraining, and mobility skills. Hand function is often a limiting factor for many patients. Tendon transfers can be used to restore function to paralyzed arms and hands by giving working muscles different jobs. Functional electrical stimulation is a technique that uses electrical currents to stimulate and activate muscles affected by paralysis. So when you think of a spinal cord injury level, it's the last functional level. So if a patient is a C5 injury level, that means that the last functioning level is the deltoid and biceps. That means the patient can abduct the shoulder and can flex the elbow to bring the hand towards his or her mouth. But because these patients don't have C6, they can't extend the wrist or cannot supinate the wrist, so these patients are unable to bring the fingers to his or her mouth. This is very different from a C6 injury level, where the patient will have wrist extension and supination, and therefore he or she is able to feed themselves. And this is the major difference between a C5 and a C6 level patient. C6 patients can usually live independently and use a manual wheelchair, while C5 level patients, on the other hand, can usually only use an electric wheelchair. So now let's get into each of the injury levels and the corresponding patient function with each injury level. A C1 to C3 injury level corresponds to a patient that is ventilator dependent with limited talking. These patients will typically need an electric wheelchair with head or chin control. A C3 to C4 injury level corresponds to a patient that is initially ventilator dependent but can become independent. They will also typically need an electric wheelchair with head or chin control. A C5 injury level corresponds to a patient that is ventilator independent. These patients have biceps, deltoid, and can flex the elbow, but lack wrist extension and supination needed to feed oneself. And as we mentioned, these patients will typically need an electric wheelchair with hand control, as they have minimal manual wheelchair function. A C6 injury level corresponds to a patient that has much better function than C5, as we mentioned, due to the ability to bring the hand to the mouth and feed oneself. And this is, of course, because wrist extension and supination is intact. These patients can usually live independently, as we mentioned. They can use a manual wheelchair with sliding board transfers and can drive a car with manual controls. A C7 injury level corresponds to a patient that has improved tricep strength and has daily use of a manual wheelchair with independent transfers. A C8 to T1 injury level corresponds to a patient that has improved hand and finger strength and dexterity, and these patients typically have fully independent transfers. A T2 to T6 injury level corresponds to a patient that has normal upper extremity function, improved trunk control, and they will be wheelchair dependent. A T7 to T12 injury level corresponds to a patient that has increased abdominal muscle control, and they are able to perform unsupported seated activities. However, with extensive bracing, walking may be possible. An L1 to L5 injury level corresponds to a patient that has variable lower extremity and bowel and bladder function. Assistive devices and bracing may be needed. An S1 to S5 injury level corresponds to a patient that has variable return of bowel and bladder, as well as sexual function, and these patients may actually be able to walk with minimal or no assistance. Now moving on to prognosis, in complete injuries, improvement of one nerve root level can be expected in 80% of patients. Improvement of two nerve root levels can be expected in 20% of patients. Only 1% have complete recovery at the time of hospital diagnosis. With incomplete injuries, some trends of improvement include that the greater the sparing, the greater the recovery. Patients that show more rapid recovery have a better prognosis, and when recovery plateaus, it rarely resumes improvement. And finally, with conus medullaris syndrome, this has better prognosis for recovery than more proximal lesions. Let's finish this review by talking about some complications, like skin problems, venous thromboembolism, urosepsis, sinus bradycardia, orthostatic hypotension, autonomic dysreflexia, and major depressive disorder. As far as skin problems, treatment is prevention, and this actually starts in the emergency room. So do not leave patients on a backboard, start log rolling early, and make sure these patients have proper bedding. As far as venous thromboembolism, prevent with immediate DVT prophylaxis. Urosepsis is a common cause of death. Strict aseptic techniques should be used when placing a catheter, and don't let the bladder become overly distended. Sinus bradycardia is the most common cardiac arrhythmia in the acute stage following spinal cord injury. Orthostatic hypotension occurs as a lack of sympathetic tone. Autonomic dysreflexia is potentially fatal. It presents with headache, agitation, hypertension, and it is caused by unchecked visceral stimulation. Make sure to check the Foley, disimpact the patient, and radiographs of the lower extremity if there is concern for an undiagnosed fracture. Finally, major depressive disorder. Approximately 11% of patients with spinal cord injuries suffer from major depressive disorder. Major depressive disorder in spinal cord injury patients is highly associated with suicidal ideation in both the acute and chronic phase. That's all for this review about spinal cord injuries. Hopefully that was helpful. Look out for questions related to this topic on this weekend's question session, and hopefully this episode will have prepared you for that review. This is the OrthoBullets podcast, a daily audio review session by OrthoBullets, the free learning and collaboration community for orthopedic surgery education. If you're enjoying the podcast so far, please consider leaving us a 5-star rating and writing us a review on iTunes. It will help us spread the word and increase our discoverability tremendously. Thanks so much, and we'll see you all tomorrow.